It's Friday, April 29, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Once again, we have been alerted to the force of nature that brings death and havoc and mayhem. Across the states of Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia, tornadoes have left a swath of destruction that can only be described as cataclysmic. As one Alabama leader said yesterday, this is our Katrina, speaking of the north and central parts of that state. Cities such as Tuscaloosa and Cullman have been almost destroyed, with large neighborhoods simply missing. Churches have been destroyed, institutions and schools destroyed, and we now know of multiple deaths as the rescue operation and recovery continues to uncover even greater devastation and death than had been expected in the initial estimates of the damage. We are so small. These storms are so large. Human beings, over against the forces of nature, are reminded of the humility of our essential condition. We are made up of bones and bodies and blood and tissues that can so easily be torn apart by the forces of nature with their raw energy and horrific power. These tornadoes, now considered to number over 150 in an outbreak spreading across multiple states, serve as a signal of the fact that we live in a fallen world in which nature, the same nature that can produce the beauty of a rose and the fantastic phenomenon of a sunset, the same nature that can produce a tranquil lake and a babbling brook, can turn with hostility that is, of course, experienced at the human level as the potential of death and destruction, but at the cosmic level is a signal of the need for redemption. As Paul tells us in Romans chapter 8, the entire cosmos is suffering under the weight of sin, awaiting the appearance of the sons of men, a sign of that day of judgment that is to come, and the kingdom brought in its fullness by the Lord Jesus Christ. We are awaiting the new creation, even as we grieve with those who have suffered so mightily in this old creation, suffering the effects of sin. Today is a day of a major historical and cultural development. Americans and those around the world are going to be glued to their television sets for something that is of genuine historical significance. And no, I am not talking about the wedding in England. I'm talking about today's expected launch of the space shuttle Endeavour, which may mark one of the very last American efforts at human spaceflight. This launch, which is going to be witnessed by President Barack Obama and many other dignitaries, will be especially poignant because Mark Kelly, the captain of this particular mission, is the wife of Representative Gabrielle Giffords, who is also to be present to witness what could be one of these most historic events in human spaceflight. Now, there's an interesting angle to this, of course, as America has shifted its interests and economic emphases elsewhere, as human spaceflight now recedes into the American past rather than into the American future. Just imagine the fact that from now on, when Americans go into space, the only way to get there until some new technology comes along and some new American program funds it, Americans are going to have to go on a Soviet rocket, or that is a Russian rocket, and are going to probably be going to the International Space Station rather than to a uniquely American space context. The New York Times, just a few days ago, had a very interesting headline, "With Coolest Job Ever Ending, Astronauts Seek Next Frontier." You know, when you think about cultural analysis, this is a very important issue. And as an American man who grew up as an American boy in the age of space travel and the space age in general, I can tell you that this is a significant shift. I was in that generation of young boys that got to see the launch of some of the earliest of America's space efforts. I grew up in Florida and from close proximity could see launches from Cape Canaveral, which was for a time called Cape Kennedy, now the Kennedy Space Center. I was there in proximity to the Cape, able to see the launch of the mission that first took human beings to the moon. I was able to see so many other things and was a part of that generation that saw this as a part of America's great step forward, of a new technological and scientific age when astronauts were the heroes, not only in terms of the scientific and technological world, but also in the world of the American imagination. Now this New York Times story tells us that the role of the astronaut may basically disappear from American culture because of the expense of space travel and of the fact that the nation has turned to other more pressing research purposes and ends. That's a very interesting closing to a chapter in American history. There may now be fewer boys and girls who are going to seek to grow up to be astronauts, and there's something of loss in that. At the same time, we do, as a nation, move on from one project to the next. It's hard to believe, however, that we will abandon for long the prospect of spaceflight, human spaceflight. The big question is, what will it be, and when will it come? There is that wedding, of course, going on in England today, and by now it should have taken place, and people around the world, many of them undoubtedly were scheduled to wake up this morning at 4 o'clock in order to see that ceremony here in the United States. That leads to a host of questions, and some of them are worthy of our consideration. First of all, why the fascination with the monarchy? In reality, many people will tell you that Americans seem to be even more fascinated with the monarchy and with the royals than do the citizens of the United Kingdom. And there's probably a good reason for that. We do not have a perpetual monarchy, a hereditary monarchy. We have instead an elected presidency. And that means that our presidents come and go. They may end up with their picture on a stamp or a coin, and they certainly end up with their names made, at least historically, immortal. But the reality is that we do not have the kind of royal heritage that the Brits have, and we do not have it for good reasons, for principled reasons. But there is a fascination with it. And from a Christian perspective, one thing to imagine in this is that human beings have a deep need for historical context. We need to know where we come in the story. One of the benefits of having a hereditary monarchy is that you mark your years, your centuries, your epochs and eras by these royals. We also have an innate hunger for authority and for formality, and all of this is reflected, of course, in our kings and our queens. And remember, of course, that Israel was told that it should not have a king. At one point, Israel sinned against God by demanding a king so that it could be just like all the other nations. Well, Israel got its kings, and if you read the Old Testament, you'll know that by and large, they were not the kings that Israel wanted, nor did they serve the Lord and please him. The reality is that every single human monarch is just a human being, affected by all the same passions, all the same limitations, and all the same sinfulness as every other, but given the opportunity for incredible power. Of course, that really doesn't apply so much to the British monarchy, where power is not so much the issue. But what you have in the British monarchy is an ongoing soap opera that is a reminder of things past, and in some odd way, a symbol of things present. All the foibles and controversies and embarrassments of the British royal family, well, they're pretty much shared by many American families in their own way. And now come along Prince William and Kate Middleton. And there is great hope and joy, both in the United States and in Great Britain, about a union that just might last. The Church of England actually issued an extraordinary prayer, which it suggested to the British people and to their own churches, to pray for this new couple that their marriage would last. It tells you something that the Church of England had to come up with what was considered a very special prayer for this occasion, to pray that in light of, well, the debacle of some recent royal marriages. But there's something else we need to consider here. Many Americans are simply so infatuated with the royals that they're going to look at this and just assume that it's a fairy princess tale come true. Well, it's a little more complicated than that. As many observers have noted, William and Kate have lived together, basically in cohabitation, for some time. Oddly enough, the royals, in this case, are once again mirroring the morality of the day, as these two, now approaching 30 years of age, have basically been living together in a sexual relationship without hiding it from the British people for all of these years. The question for this couple is if they really want to make that commitment together in public, and if they really want to, and here's the language you often hear, take the risk of marriage. That's a fascinating sign of our times, isn't it? It wasn't the risk of establishing a sexual relationship. It wasn't the risk of establishing a sexual intimacy without marriage. Rather, the risk is described as marriage. Several observers across the international scene have suggested that in this respect, William and Kate represent a rather paradigmatic modern couple. Well, that tells us a great deal about modernity, about modern marriage, and about modern romance. When Americans are watching this supposedly fairy tale story, most of them will try to put the moral questions out of their mind. And that, of course, is when we join that conspiracy Paul talked about in Romans chapter 1 of suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. A couple of technological issues should have our attention as we go into the weekend. First of all, the New York Times is reporting on a study undertaken by Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Fogel and a small group of associates that has found something that we desperately need to know. The study is entitled The Changing Body, Health, Nutrition, and Human Development in the Western World Since 1700. Well, you just know that's going to be a blockbuster of a study. And here is the bottom line, no pun intended, of what they discovered. As human beings have advanced in technology, we work less. We become more, well, large. Here's the headline. Technology advances, humans supersize. It's actually a more complicated story than that. It has to do with the fact that with the development of modern fertilizer, modern agriculture, modern diets, the availability of food, and conquering many diseases by antibiotics and other means, human beings are healthier, and that means they get larger. Then add to that the fact that we no longer do physical labor, and there's another way we get larger. So there you have a Nobel Prize-winning economist and a group of colleagues who devoted years of study to going back from 1700 to the present to discover that if you're holding an iPad, you're probably bigger than your ancestors, as if we didn't know that already. And technology, of course, took quite a hit this week with a report that Apple and Google were collecting user data on location by means of the iPad, iPhone, and Android instruments. A great deal of controversy has now attached itself to this question, with people wondering if their movements are being watched. Well, that's a very interesting question, isn't it? First of all, simple logic should suggest that if you have a device on your person that can instantly, by GPS, locate where you are and follow where you're going, it just might be that that data exists. I don't understand how that is a surprise. It just might be that that data is being tracked by someone. But since there's not a little person in your phone who's actually looking at the map for you, that means that somebody outside yourself knows where you are, at least electronically, and is able to track you. That's an interesting question. But more interesting, isn't it, is the fact that many people seem to say, well, that's a trade-off I'm willing to have. I'm willing to have the trade-off of someone being able to track where I am so that I, for that matter, know where I am and have the smartphone, able to do all the smart things smart people buy a smartphone to do. But there are those who are saying, I don't want to be tracked. There may be some who are worried about some kind of international criminal conspiracy to track them down. But isn't it interesting to know that many people are saying, I don't want this because I don't want anyone to know where I am. I don't want anyone to know where I'm going. Well, that's where, from a Christian perspective, it's good for all of us to remember someone does know where we are, someone does know where we're going, and someone does know where we've been. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at www.albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.